According to the National Institute of Mental Health, about 50 million adult Americans live with a diagnosable mental health disorder. Despite its prevalence, our guest this week confronts a lot of myths in the discussion of mental health issues in America. He's Paul Gianfrido, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello, and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we discuss the stories, the myths, and the narratives that shape public issues in the United States. This week, we turn again to healthcare, and mental health in particular. Joining us is Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America. Paul, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
So let's start with just a quick overview of mental health, because the numbers, the statistics from the National Institutes of Mental Health are really sort of staggering. So one in five, or roughly 50 million adult Americans, live with a diagnosable mental disorder. Some 10 million have serious functional impairment due to mental illness, such as a psychotic or a serious mood or anxiety disorder. And 20% of children ages 13 to 18 currently have and or previously had a debilitating mental disorder. Besides the fact that we just talked about it here, does the American public understand the extent of this issue?
I don't think so. And one of the other things that I don't think people really understand is that half of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14, three quarters by the age of 25. So these are primarily diseases of childhood. At least they begin during childhood, but they're chronic diseases. And so people end up living with serious and often untreated mental health concerns and conditions for years before getting any kinds of services or supports.
And are parents well enough aware of the fact that it's not just that your child's developing differently, but there could be an underlying medical condition?
Not really. We do widespread screening for children for vision, so parents are pretty much always aware if their kids have trouble seeing.
Right. Yeah.
Widespread screening for hearing, so they're aware of that. But even though widespread screening for mental health concerns and conditions is recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the reality is it's not done. It's not done in pediatricians' offices. It's not done in schools. So parents are often left guessing about what's going on with their kids and whether or not their child is different from the other children.
And so what's the barrier? Why aren't these screenings done?
Well, one of the barriers that we've got is that people are simply afraid of it. They don't want necessarily an over-labeling of a child. They don't want a child to be labeled with something that people have been told equates to being making that child someday a danger to themselves or others. So there's a lot of discrimination around that. There's a lot of concern around that. But the reality is that most mental health concerns and conditions, people do live with them, and they're very treatable, and people can move on pathways to recovery. But unless we're willing to say that and to stop using mental illnesses as a surrogate for danger to self or others, we're not going to get over that hurdle and have people endorse and embrace the concept of early identification and intervention.
So if you look at these numbers that Jim was just describing, these are very large numbers. If you look at the numbers of people directly affected by mental health issues and conditions and people whose lives they in turn affect, is there really any family or any individual who isn't touched in some fashion by mental health or by mental illness?
Not really. Half of us will have a diagnosable mental illness during the course of our lifetime. So if you make it one out of two, not just the one out of five in any given year who might have a diagnosable mental health concern, it's pretty clear that it's in every family. And a lot of times, if you think back, people in our generation would say, well, we knew about that uncle who maybe drank too much, or we knew about that cousin who just didn't come out of their house. What we were dealing with was a lot of undiagnosed and untreated mental health concerns, and we've got to do a whole lot better than that for our children these days.
So where does advocacy start? I mean, obviously your group and your efforts are instrumental in bringing greater awareness to these issues, and also in breaking down the stigma and the fear and the shame and the embarrassment, other factors that keep people from seeking treatment. And there are many effective treatments and help. So what else can be done?
Yeah, well, from our standpoint at Mental Health America, you know, we're the oldest mental health advocacy organization in the nation. We were the National Mental Health Association for most of our lifetime. We've been around for nearly 110 years now. We believe in working on prevention for all, early identification and intervention for people at risk, integrated health, behavioral health, and other services for people who need them, with recovery as a goal. From my perspective, the problem that we've had is that we have, by having this danger to self or others standard that's been used as a matter of public policy as a trigger to treatment, it's made mental illnesses the only chronic disease in America that we wait till stage four to treat, and then often inappropriately only through incarceration. We have to act before stage four, because that's how we get good results, and that's how we move people on pathways to recovery. So that's where advocacy begins. It begins before stage four with our children and young adults, making certain that we can change trajectories of lives.
So why is advocacy even necessary in a case like this? With the kinds of numbers that we're talking about, why isn't there, you know, why aren't we marching in the streets? Why isn't this just a demand of the American public, with so many people touched by these issues? Why isn't there more of a cry for action?
Yeah, why is a good question. But when you frame this as a public safety issue, throughout all of our lifetimes, this has been framed as a public safety issue. A lot of times people don't want to defend the criminals. They don't want to defend people who they think are at risk of harming them or harming some other people. When you reframe this as a public health issue, which is what it is, and a health concerning condition, then you start having people saying, maybe we need to do something about this. And really, in the last couple years especially, I think we've seen a dramatic shift beginning in our policy making and in our overall thinking about mental health concerns and conditions, really toward thinking about them as health issues that we can affect and we can change, and we can, in doing something about, make our lives better.
So talk for a minute about violence.
Mm-hmm.
I've written about mental health and done films for many, many years. And what I have seen from the inside, and also as an outside observer, is a lot of people do not pay attention to mental health in any fashion unless there is violence.
Right.
Somebody takes a gun, kills somebody, somebody commits suicide. Talk about the reality of violence and mental illness. It's a myth.
Yeah,
that is persisting here.
Yeah, it is a myth. The reality is that there's not a strong correlation between violence and mental illness at all. If anybody wants any indication of how that can be with 50 million people who have a diagnosable mental illness in any given year, think about how many times you actually read about the connection between mental illness and a violent act. And remember that we're pretty much reading about almost all of the ones where that connection is being made. So if it's a few a year, that makes some sense. And the reality is, though, because people are so overwhelmed by that news, and really in the entertainment media, people have for so long to wrap up plot lines in 22 minutes, simply have the person become mentally ill and have that become the explanation for why they engaged in some violent act. This is what we're up against. And the truth of it is that over the course of the last 20 to 25 years, it's gotten worse, not better. People are more likely to make this correlation between violence and mental illness than they were even 25 years ago. You do that, it does make it tough to shift people's thinking and to get the ground to shift a little bit into thinking, well, wait a minute. We're not dealing with a lot of violent people here. We're dealing with people who've got some illnesses, and we can treat them, and we can move people on pathways to recovery really kind of quickly if we treat most of them, just like we can with cancer, if we get it at stage one and don't wait till stage four. That's what we have to do.
So you mentioned something a moment ago. You talked about a dramatic shift in recent years in the, both the care and the treatment of people with mental health issues. What is that dramatic shift? And are we talking about the Affordable Care Act? Are we talking about something else? And do you see that shift continuing in the current policy environment?
I think the Affordable Care Act helps some by making mental health benefits essential health benefits. I think the Mental Health Parity Act from 2008 helped some also by saying you've got to cover, if you're going to cover health conditions and include mental health conditions, you've got to cover them at parity. But I also think that last year, when the 21st Century Cures Act was passed and was the final law that President Obama signed into law, the final major law, and had all of the mental health reform provisions that had been worked on over the last couple of years, what had happened that a lot of people don't know, the part of that story is that we ended up with strong bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. And pretty much the entirety of the mental health advocacy community came together around agreeing that while all of us may not agree about the specific things that we would want done in every given instance, we all could agree that it was time to do something because nothing major had been done since 1963 when President Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Centers Act as part of the last act he signed before his assassination. So I think people just got tired of doing nothing and recognizing that, you know, we can't continue to just send people with serious mental illnesses to jails and prisons and expect those custodial care institutions to replace the custodial care institutions of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. It's about time we start looking at what we've been doing here and doing it a whole lot better.
So that was a significant milestone. But where do we stand now, 100 days, give or take a few, into the presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, as we were talking here, the skinny budget was released, and the skinny budget, so-called, much of which doesn't have any numbers in it, but just some of the summaries of what the administration plans to introduce as numbers, said that there would be more funding for children's mental health, said that there would be more funding for suicide prevention, said there'd be more funding for substance use disorder, and said there'd be more funding for adult mental health services, particularly for adults with serious mental illnesses. We've just got to see whether that actually happens. One of the things that happened in the law last year is that we got authorizations for additional funding, but in the Congress, an authorization doesn't mean you get the appropriation. So now we got to work on whether or not people are willing to put their money where their mouth is. Now, policymakers as a group have not been willing to do that with mental health concerns and conditions. At the state level, between 2009 and 2013, you know, they cut $4.6 billion from state mental health budgets.
Oh, wow.
That's four times the amount of money that the federal government spends on all of the mental health services that it provides through SAMHSA every given year. So we'll see if money follows the talking at this point, but we have every indication from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers and from the administration, they're all willing to put some money into this and start changing this reality.
What do you think accounts for that greater willingness? Is it simply just the passage of time, or is it, I mean, so we, you know, the point about violence and mental health issues is well taken, mm-hmm. but there is a recognition of every time you see a mass shooting, there's often, you know, I think almost exclusively, they're able to document some sort of either undiagnosed or diagnosed mental health issue in the person who was the committer of the attack. And there seemed to be, after some of the attacks during the Obama administration, there was a pivot to talk about mental health instead of talking about guns. And so you sort of got this false dichotomy between one or the other, either do something about guns or do something about mental health. Is that political construct useful, not useful? How, in terms of from where you sit at Mental Health America, how does that context shake out?
Well, it wasn't useful at all because while some people were talking about let's deal with guns and other people were talking about let's deal with mental illnesses as the reason that we've got violent acts, both of them were getting nowhere because neither one of those things was going to answer the problem that we had, which is this is a major public health crisis. Mm-hmm. I think what's made the difference really are narratives, stories. The fact that people are finally finding stories to which they can relate. These are stories that have been in their families for years and years but haven't been told. But when some of us start telling our stories and the stories of our families, people come out of the woodwork and say, that's my story too. And I think that's what's made the most significant difference is people for the first time beginning to understand that the people who are homeless on the streets were those cute kids in first grade who began to show signs and symptoms of mental illnesses. That many of the people who were in our jails, prisons, and our homeless population, even those who have ended up with violent actions, either suicide or homicide for that matter, are people who exhibited signs and symptoms when they did of mental illnesses many years before that people ignored.
We got to take a quick moment for station identification, primarily for the benefit of our radio audience. Story in the Public Square can be heard four times each weekend on SiriusXM's popular channel, Politics of the United States, the POTUS channel, 124. Our broadcast is produced each week by a tremendous team at Rhode Island PBS in beautiful Providence, Rhode Island. My name is Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. If you want to tweet me, I'm at JM Lutis. As always, I'm joined by G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. You can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is President and CEO of Mental Health America, one of the country's leading community health organizations focused on the needs of those living with mental health issues. He's Paul Gianfrido, and you can tweet him at Mental Health AM. It's Mental Health AM for short for America. I wonder, could you talk to us a little bit about the role that the media plays in perpetuating the kinds of myths that we've been talking about today?
Well, the media folks have a tremendous responsibility here, both for the way we perceive mental illnesses and for the mental health myths, but also a tremendous responsibility for being part of the solution here, because quite a number of folks in the media have been really working hard to try to dispel some of these myths. Really what's happened, I think, initially was that when we ended up with a 24-hour news cycle, we looked for easy answers. We looked for the quick response because people were demanding that. We didn't have time to wait for the 6:30 newscast the next night to get all the work done. So people went to easy explanations for things. And I just remember when the pilot flew the jet into the mountain a few years back, yeah, and taking 150 lives along with him, the media here immediately went to the fact that he had been diagnosed with a mental health condition like 6 years earlier, one episode of major depressive disorder, as if that were the reason that he then flew his airplane into the side of a mountain. Well, there are millions of people walking around with major depressive disorder who don't fly airplanes into the sides of mountains or do anything equivalent to that. So when we actually challenged them about taking this easy route, we began to see a change with some of the national media the next day, maybe sort of dropping that out and saying, maybe we do have to do our homework and see if it really was part of the reason that this occurred. So I think on the news side, it's just important to get the stories, the full story straight. And on the entertainment side, we really have to get beyond, you know, do you have to always make the person, you know, to explain it and wrap it up, as I said, in 22 minutes? Do you have to make that person a psychopath, a sociopath? Or what would be the popular idea of what a sociopath or psychopath might be? Or is it time to recognize that people are nuanced? And so many of the shows in newer shows in the entertainment media, I think, are taking a much more nuanced look at people with behavioral health conditions in general.
You made a very good point earlier in terms of the power of personal narrative, people sharing the stories of themselves or their loved ones and family members. I've covered mental health for a long time. I have made it a policy of, with maybe one or two exceptions, to always use a full name, a full photograph, full details, because my belief was that you kind of knock back stigma by showing real people as real people. And I think we're seeing more of that today, not simply in my work, but in a lot of people's work. Which brings me to your son. Mm-hmm. You have written a book. Your son lives with mental illness. You've written an essay that appeared in Health Affairs in the Washington Post, and a book, Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. Talk about Tim and the road to this book.
Well, you know, Tim is just a very typical young person, young man who had the misfortune of being affected by schizophrenia. His signs and symptoms of his illness emerged about the time he was 5 years old, and he has lived with it for more than a quarter of a century. He had struggled not so much with the condition as with societal responses to the condition, because whenever there was a behavioral manifestation, things would happen like Tim would get suspended from school or expelled from school. When Tim was an adult, he got fired from his job. He's been evicted from housing multiple times. And what's happened to Tim is the same thing that's happened to so many people like Tim. And there are people who oftentimes we see out on the streets and the street corners He ended up for most of his adult life now, and he's 32 years old, in the revolving door of occasional hospitalization, chronic homelessness, and frequent incarceration. For him, he lives in San Francisco right now, lived in Austin before that. His two most common addresses as an adult have been the San Francisco County Jail and the Travis County Jail in Del Valle, Texas, right outside of Austin. What Tim has been willing to let me do is tell his story. Tim has authorized me to do so. He signed releases when people have asked for image releases and have asked for media releases so that we can talk about this and write about this, because he's more than willing to share this story. I don't think he expects much out of us anymore. He and I are pretty close, and we get to talk from time to time now that he's been more in services and supports over the course of the last year. But he has long since, I think, lost faith, if you want to call it that, in the policy environment and society's ability to make his life better. So he patiently goes along, does what he can himself to make his life better, and is willing to let his story be told, believing that maybe it'll make a difference in the lives of some other folks.
Very powerful thing that he has done. I mean, it sounds like he's done this out of the goodness of his heart, for lack of a better word. I mean, does he understand, or do you talk about how sharing his story, him sharing it, you writing it, is important?
Absolutely.
It's a very powerful book.
Yeah, no, thank you. And we have talked about that. And fortunately, you know, we have a similar kind of a sense of humor. And so Tim's basic reaction to this is, oh, maybe I'll get famous. I say, well, you know, you're kind of a little famous already, you know, as the story has been out there for so long. But the truth of it is, you know, people ask, you know, when they read this story or hear this story, they say, what can I do for Tim? You know, how can I help Tim now? And I like to tell people that what you need to do is turn back the clock and don't think about how you can help Tim right now. Think about how you could have helped Tim 25 years ago, because those are the Tims that we really need to be talking about. Those are the kids who, before the age of 14, are showing these signs and symptoms of mental illness, who their schools wait until their behavioral problems and then toss them out, whose parents are a little worried that we're not quite sure what we need to happen, but don't take them in for an evaluation, whose pediatricians say, well, they're developing normally, physically, but don't do a simple behavioral health screening that's just a few questions to ask them to see if the child is also developing on the right pathway in terms of their mental health. And that's what we need to do. We need to figure out how to start when they're kids, because when we start when they're kids, we'll be much more sensitive to their needs when they're adults.
You spent 13 years of your life as a full-time elected official, principally as a state legislator in the great state of Connecticut, my home. You were elected mayor of Middletown.
Yes.
What did being in that policy environment as a state legislator, as a mayor of a mid-sized town, what did that teach you about government's ability to help with this set of issues?
Oh, it taught me that government certainly is able to. It's just not always willing to help with this set of issues. That, you know, people in the interest of short-sighted, you know, let's reduce our taxes, end up building long-term lots of jails and prisons to house people who could have led fully productive and independent lives and could be leading those full productive and independent lives today. So I certainly have come out of it believing that the work that the Congress did last year, the work that we did at the state level, is important work and can change trajectories of lives. And also understanding two other things. One is, it doesn't matter what connections you have. You know, people say to me, look at all the connections you had. Look at, you know, you could get anything you wanted for services for your child. Look how it happened. Can you imagine what it would be like for people who didn't have those connections? Well, the answer is about the same. It doesn't matter what connections you have. This is an equal opportunity, you know, affliction that we get. And I get that from other people's narratives. Doesn't matter. I've had doctors, lawyers, psychiatrists come up to me and say, yeah, when this happened to me, same thing happened. The other thing, frankly, that it's taught me is that to understand that when you want to place blame, right, we typically place blame on first those individuals like Tim. Well, why can't they just pay attention? Why can't they just, you know, pull themselves up by their own bootstraps?
Buck up, soldier.
Buck up, right? Yeah. And then when we stop doing that, we blame their parents. And we say, well, why couldn't you raise them better than that? And what my policy experience taught me was, you want to blame me for something, blame me as a policymaker. That's when I had all of the power to put dollars wherever we needed to do it. Don't blame me as a parent for failing my kid. How our health and education systems failed my son with schizophrenia. This is a systems problem. Blame us as policymakers. We could have done a whole lot better job. And so can policymakers today do a whole lot better job for all of our kids like Tim.
It's powerful.
It is powerful. As a state elected official for 13 mm-hmm. years, you had sort of a front row seat to the movement called deinstitutionalization mm-hmm. During the 80s and 90s. So the roots actually go to the 70s. And there was noble intent. It was to close these warehouses, psychiatric institutions, most of them state-run, not all of them, where people are abused, neglected, thrown away, and their lives disappear. So it was noble intent. The other side of the equation was, we're going to move people out and keep them from going to these places, but build a community mental health system so that they can live productive lives in the community. What happened there? The second part of the equation didn't really happen there.
Yeah, it didn't. We didn't build the community mental health systems that we needed to build. So what we ended up doing was, with our noble intent, as I mentioned before, we just simply moved people from one kind of custodial care institution that kept them behind locked doors that we called the state hospital into another kind of custodial care institution behind locked doors that we now call our county jails and our state prisons. That's what we've done. That's the system that we've built. And I was a part of that, because even though I did all that I thought I could do to try to build community-based systems of care and services, and I was very much on that pathway when I had control over the budgets in the state, and I had control as the chair of the Public Health Committee over the legislation also. So I had both the appropriations control and the policy control in Connecticut for 10 years. And while some of us were doing all we thought we could do, there were a lot of things we didn't understand. I mean, we didn't know that half of mental illnesses emerged by the age of 14. We didn't know, therefore, we had to build systems of care that would serve our kids, that the people coming out of the state hospitals didn't look like the people going into them. The people coming out were adults. People going in were kids. We didn't know that we had to build a system of care and supports that put health professionals at the head of it, not sheriffs, you know, not police officers. And we didn't know, really, that if we didn't do this, we thought, boy, nothing could be worse than those state institutions we had. Well, our jails and prisons have turned out to be, in many instances, worse.
We need to leave it at that sobering thought. Paul Gianfrido, the book is Losing Tim, and we highly recommend it. He's president and CEO of Mental Health America. If you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, including catching up on missed episodes, please visit us at pellcenter.org. And throughout the week, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Story in the Public Square.